in the matter of State versus Macchia.
Macchia. He pronounces it Macchia. The Italian is probably Macchia, but he pronounces it Macchia. John Vincent Zakanik, 1135 Clifton Avenue, Clifton, New Jersey, on behalf of the defendant petitioner, Joseph Macchia.
Good morning, Your Honors. Laura B. Lasota, Assistant Deputy Public Defender, on behalf of the Office of the Public Defender, appearing as amicus curiae.
Good morning, Your Honors. Rachel E. Simon, from the law firm of Pashman Simon and Walter Hayden, appearing on behalf of the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey as amicus curiae.
Good morning, Your Honors. Assistant Prosecutor Michelle Buckley from Union County on behalf of the state.
Stephen A. Yomtov, Deputy Attorney General, representing the Attorney General of New Jersey, amicus curiae.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Mr. Zakanik, please.
Your Honor, I would like to reserve rebuttal time, if I may.
That's fine.
I will rely on my supplemental brief and the excellent briefs of the two amici that they wrote for Mr. Macchia. This is a novel question, Your Honors, as to whether a specific unanimity charge should have been given in the self-defense case and for amici in all self-defense cases. While the facts generally are not relevant to this court, they're important here in the sense that the video reveals that Mr. Macchia never once struck Michael Gaffney in any way. Per the stipulation, Mr. Macchia was an off-duty Newark police officer, 5'9" and weighed 190. Mr. Gaffney was 6'3" and weighed 240, and he was described by witnesses as twice the size of Mr. Macchia. I would also like to point out that the video contradicts the state's contention on page 9 of its supplemental brief that Mr. Lima pulled Mr. Gaffney off of Mr. Macchia prior to firing his weapon. I submit that that's not there. Mr. Gaffney brutally beat Mr. Macchia, breaking his nose, severely spraining his left wrist, and pounding Mr. Macchia's head into the pavement to the extent that Mr. Macchia feared he was going to lose consciousness and feared Mr. Macchia, who knew Mr. Macchia was a police officer, was reaching for his gun, which was on his right hip. He felt his shirt going up. Number one, Mr. Macchia honestly and reasonably believed the use of force was necessary to save his own life or avoid serious bodily harm, the necessity prong disqualifier. Number two, he clearly did not provoke the encounter with the purpose to kill or cause serious bodily harm, the provocation prong. And number three, he could not have retreated as he was being savagely beaten on the ground and felt Mr. Gaffney reaching for a service revolver and that he was about to lose consciousness. That's the retreat prong, the third disqualifier. His decision-making process was not only reasonable, honest, and logical, but the only one to be expected of a normal person, especially an off-duty police officer who was trained not to fire a warning shot. Your Honors, I submit this is a classic self-defense case, not a manslaughter case. If this was a stand-your-ground state, Mr. Macchia might not have even been charged. As to the law and the issue before this court, once self-defense is placed in issue, which of course it was in this case, the state must disprove self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. And I submit that the jury must be unanimous as to which elements of self-defense the state has to disprove, and a specific unanimity instruction should have been given in this case. Here, at trial on June 7th, 2018, right after jury instructions, the jury asked, quote, "Do all three questions have to be a yes for it to be self-defense, or just one of the three be self-defense?" End quote. That's C-12, and it's annexed to my appellate division brief at DA 190. This question not only exemplifies the jury confusion, but highlights the need for specific unanimity instruction in this case. But I disagree with the jury's ultimate verdict of guilt. We could not have asked for a more pristine and cogent jury request. Had the trial court given that specific unanimity instruction, I submit the verdict would have been not guilty, or at the very least, we wouldn't be here today because I wouldn't have that issue. The next day, the jury advisor was hung and was told to go back and deliberate some more. On June 13, 2018, based on C-12, the jury note, Mr. Stephen Brzezik, trial counsel, astutely raised by way of an email to the court the issue before this court. And it's the only document I annexed to my supplemental brief, and believe me, I've done some very long appendixes. Trial attorney Stephen Brzezik's email correctly finds that the jury's question suggests that the jury was not unanimous regarding whether any single element of self-defense had been disproved by the state. And I submit that really all Your Honors need is C-12, the jury note, and Mr. Brzezik's email. Those are the essential two documents to look at to decide this issue. Mr. Brzezik's email also proves that this issue was raised below. Even if this court doesn't find that and finds the plain error standard should be applied, I submit that, quote, the error was clearly capable of producing an unjust result, unquote. That's Rule 212.2. But it was raised below. He wrote an email 5 o'clock in the morning, and the judge could have instructed the jury, which was obviously struggling, but he just didn't do so. So I submit it's not a plain error standard, and it was raised below. The conviction should be reversed, and this is the heart of my argument, because it is unknown, Your Honors, if all 12 jurors agreed that one of the 3 self-defense disqualifiers had been proven beyond a reasonable doubt, or 4 jurors or some other numbers have found that the first of the 3 disqualifiers had been proven beyond a reasonable doubt, the necessity prong, another 4 jurors or some other number had found that the second of the 3 disqualifiers had been so proven, the provocation prong, with the final 4 jurors or some other combination, finding that the third of the 3 disqualifiers had been so proven, the retreat prong, with none of the 3 individual disqualifiers having been proven beyond a reasonable doubt to the satisfaction of all 12 jurors. This court, I respectfully submit, should not accept such a fragmented, patchwork, quasi-unanimity instruction, which unquestionably, understandably, caused jury confusion. And it was such a simple thing for the judge to have done. I just don't understand why he didn't do it. I cite to this court's decision in Frisbee, 174 NJ 583, 2002, which is very positive for me, and a rule of specific unanimity instruction should have been given in that case. And I also cite Parker and Gandhi for the language on the law. I also strongly rely on the appellate division cases of Tyndall, Gentry, Jackson, and Bezora. Here, the prosecutor argued that it disproved all 3 self-defense elements by distinct evidence in the record. And this is crucial for discounting the appellate division decision. The prosecutor argued at trial, number 1, Mr. Macchia did not reasonably believe he had to use deadly force to protect his own life because Mr. Macchia was not reaching for the gun. Mr. Gaffney, rather, was not reaching for Mr. Macchia's gun.
Mr. Sincanic?
Yes.
We don't need to get too much more deeply into the facts here. We have a straightforward legal question. And let's start with the basic proposition that the state has the obligation to prove each element of an offense beyond a reasonable doubt.
Correct.
What's the element here? Is it to disprove self-defense, or is it to disprove why there was?
The 3 disqualifiers, they have to prove that's what they have to do.
I'm trying to conform it to our understanding of basic principles. Explain why it is that each component constitutes an element of the offense, if you would.
Because there are 3 disqualifiers in the statute. The statute states those things have to be disproven by the state. They are elements. I mean, that's the rub. Are they elements or not? And obviously the state's arguing they're not elements. I submit they are elements.
Tell us why.
I would cite the United States Supreme Court case of, I would say, In re Winship, 397 U.S. 358, 1970, holding a due process requires proof beyond a reasonable doubt of every fact necessary to constitute the crime. Shad v. Arizona, determining that due process does not require a jury to agree on one of the alternative theories of premeditated murder.
Have you reviewed the Connecticut Supreme Court's recent ruling in
Mekoshvili? Yes.
Tell us what's wrong with the reasoning of that decision.
I submit we don't have to follow it, and the law in that state is different. The law below is different. They don't have what we have. Even Parker's a good law for us.
Has any court ever agreed that a jury must be unanimous in its reasoning for rejecting self-defense or any other affirmative defense?
Any court anywhere?
Correct.
Well, I did not find a court that did. This court, I believe, did in Frisbee.
Frisbee was a case with inconsistent aspects that were presented to the jury. Were the 3 bases in this case, the 3 components, inconsistent with one another?
Yes, I submit they are.
How so?
Because it's different facts, different situation.
Well, different facts doesn't necessarily make them inconsistent. If I remember Frisbee correctly, you had actual abuse versus the parent not being present, clear inconsistency. Do you have that type of inconsistency in this case?
Arguably not a clear inconsistency, but the prosecutor, there's no question, relied on all 3 disqualifiers and factually stated that in his summation. It wasn't just one. So we just don't know what the jurors did, if they went 3, 5, whatever. I mean, we just don't know. And clearly, it has to be an element. I mean, in a way, it's so logical.
That's the question, isn't it?
Yes, but it's, I mean, look at a 2C, look at the statute. Use of force is self-protection. Use of force is justifiable. The use of force is not justifiable unless the actor reasonably believes such force is necessary to protect himself against death or that necessary harm, that necessity prong. A, the actor with purpose of causing death or serious bodily harm provoked the use of force against himself, the provocation, and then you have...
We're familiar with the prongs of
the retreat. I know, but it's the law. In a way, I'm missing something here. Like, it should be an element. It has to be an element. It's in the model code.
To the logical connection between the three aspects. And I'm interested in the views of everyone on this in terms of the structure of the statute. You did refer to what, in shorthand, can be called the necessity aspect, right? So reasonable force is necessary for the protection of the defendant.
Correct.
Right?
First prong.
The first prong. In my mind, I'm having a little difficulty seeing how provocation fits in as compared with retreat. With regard to retreat, it seems like if we did Venn diagrams, right, and looked at, you know, the bigger circle and the smaller circle, it seems like the ability to safely retreat, and of course not in the home, the ability to retreat is a subset of whether there is necessity or a need for reasonable force to repel. Because if you can get away, then logically you shouldn't need to use lethal force to repel. I think that may be different, though, than looking at provocation. You know, the defendant started the altercation, and let's say it escalates. At that point, is there no possibility that the defendant can use reasonable force to defend the defendant? So I'm having trouble. It looks like, at least in my mind, the ability to retreat seems like an obvious subset of the bigger question. I'm not so sure about provocation, but let's just stick with the subset for a moment. Wouldn't it be adequate to simply ask the question about necessity? You know, was it necessary to save his own life, avoid serious bodily injury, and so on? Would that solve it by simply asking that question and not asking about the other two possibilities?
Well, because the statute has the other element, the other disqualifiers. I misspoke.
Right, but what's the logical structure there? Why?
It's a fact question for the jury.
Isn't it logical to say that they're subsumed within necessity?
I don't think they're subsumed within necessity. I just don't. I think it's a fact question for the jury. And I didn't write the statute, Your Honors. But it's in the statute what the state has to disprove. And they're clearly separate disqualifiers. It's distinct. And here the prosecutor relied on all three, and the jury was puzzled. They didn't know, you know, what it meant. It's such a simple thing to fix. Yes, you got to be unanimous as to necessity, unanimous as to provocation, or unanimous as the retreat. It's such a simple thing. Why, I mean, what's the big deal? I don't understand. Again, I'm not answering Your Honor's question.
If the jury, and you know, I'll just take one more question on this. What if the jury unanimously came back and said that there was the ability, there was the ability to retreat, but they also said reasonable deadly force was not necessary? Wouldn't that be sort of inconsistent?
Would it be 12-0? Is that what you're saying? They came back 12-0?
Pardon me?
Would that be a disqualified?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It'd be guilty.
Would it be an inconsistent verdict, though, to say that there was the ability to retreat, but that reasonable force was nonetheless necessary? I have trouble reconciling those two things.
I didn't write the statute. Obviously, somebody thought that they were different and they're distinct. But maybe my amici could come up with a hypothetical that would do that. But the statute is what we're dealing with. I apologize. I can't answer you. I'm sorry. I can't think of it. I know what you're saying, but I mean, we're talking about what's here. And here you have three disqualifiers. And the way the law is now, we don't know whether it's 12-0 on each one. I submit their elements. It should be 12-0. That's my argument. I apologize for the third or fourth time if I didn't answer your question.
If the jury finds that, I mean, talking about the structure and how these all relate, if the jury finds that the belief was not honest and reasonable, they don't even get to determine whether he could have retreated and therefore self-defense.
If it's 12-0. That's my argument.
That's your argument.
It's not hard to write a jury instruction. You've got to be unanimous.
Right,
it's simple.
Just talking about the structure, because in order to, you know, the state must disprove, although defendant's belief was honest and reasonable and defendant did not provoke, defendant could have retreated. But if the jury has already determined that the belief was not honest and reasonable, then you don't even get to
I think it could be any of the three disqualifiers. But my argument is that it has to be 12-0. And we have to know that. And we don't know that in this case, in Mr. Macchia's case. I mean, even though he's going to be released next August, he's done almost all his time, he was entitled to a fair trial. And I submit he didn't have a fair trial, and the judge had every opportunity to do the right thing, and he did not. Mr. Bridgick did a great job submitting that email. The jury was clearly puzzled, not only with C-12, but with C-17 as well. They said, you know, could you give it to us in plain English?
So when it comes to the jury confusion, let's say we agreed with you that the jury was confused about whether the state had to disprove self-defense through all three. You're calling them prongs. We could call them reasons, or through only one of the three. What do you have in the record to show that the jury was confused or disagreed as to which particular reason the state disproved self-defense?
I submit C-12. It's a DA 190 quote. Do all three questions have to be a yes for it to be self-defense, or just one of the three be self-defense?
Correct, but that sounds to me like the jury is asking, if the state were to disprove one of these means, then is that enough, or does the state have to disprove all three?
That's one way to read it, yeah.
My question is, where is there support in the record for the fact that the jury all agreed that one means was disproven, but disagreed as to which one means that was?
Perhaps I'm inferring it from that, and also that C-17, they said, can you give it to us in plain English? They were confused. I don't think there's any question the jury was confused. I think that's a very significant issue in this case.
There was a resolution to that.
But they found them guilty, and I submit they shouldn't have.
Give me just a second.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay. There was a resolution to that. Everybody agreed as to what the court would explain on that, and there was a quite clear response to that issue about one of three versus all three.
Mr. Brzezik's email was not given to the juries. It was not. He asked them.
But there was an agreement.
That's my argument.
How the court would address the issue of one versus three.
Didn't Mr. Brzezik agree after he sent the email?
I don't think he had any choice.
This is what Justice Patterson is referring to.
Hold on. Yeah. While the questions are posed, if you could just.
Sorry, I apologize.
Thanks.
Didn't he agree that after he sent the email that it wasn't yet ripe, and that if the jury came back again, then that was something that the judge could explain, but that the judge didn't need to at that point?
Well, for purposes of the appeal, he certainly raised it below. Whether he assented, what else was he going to do? He asked the judge to give it, and the judge said, no, we're going to let them deliberate some more. Now is not the appropriate time. He should have done it. Why didn't he give it to them? That's my argument.
The court really disputed the suggestion in the email that this had been raised before. The court had some concerns about the way that the email characterized the history of this issue, and so stated.
Well, even under the plain error standard, I submit the conviction should be reversed either way if it's not considered raised properly below. But I submit it was the most perspicacious email by Mr. Brzezik. I think he did a phenomenal job at the trial. I just want to say that. The jury was good with their question, C-12 and even C-17. I think the trial judge just was wrong. And it was such a simple thing to do. And not only in this case, but in all self-defense cases. Because we just don't know. That's the problem. We don't know. And they have to be considered elements. They're in the statute. Any reading, you would think it has to be 12-0. Or the jury has to be told. It has to be 12-0, or it doesn't have to be 12-0. One or the other, it has to be cleared up. And it wasn't done in this case, and it should have been done.
I think we have your position. Is there anything you'd like to add?
No, Your Honors.
We'll have you back for rebuttal. Mr. Soda.
May it please the court. A specific unanimity instruction informing the jury that it must be unanimous as to the element of self-defense it has found that the state has disproven is necessary to protect a defendant's constitutional right to a unanimous verdict. It's really two issues I want to raise in support of that argument today. The first is that elements of self-defense should be treated just like elements of an offense for purposes of unanimity. And the second is that our case law actually calls for a specific unanimity instruction when it comes to the issue of self-defense. With regards to my first argument, Your Honors, as we know, when self-defense is raised in the case, it is treated as an element of the offense. It then follows that these three elements of self-defense should be treated just the same for purposes of unanimity. Chief, I think you had asked the question about what makes these elements. When we look at them, they not only are they distinct for purposes of the Parker test, but they all include different actus reus and mens rea components. They're distinct considerations that the jury has to make based on different evidence in order to find that the state has disproven each one of these. They are not conceptually similar at all, especially when you look at some of these, such as provocation and retreat. Those two things are just so contradictory to one another that these cannot be said to be all so interrelated. Of course, they do fall under the umbrella of self-defense, but they're just all so different. And I know for purposes of the statute, my colleague at the ACDL is going to go a little more into what makes them elements for purposes of our criminal code. But going forward,
couldn't all three be proven by the state, disproven?
Not all three. It's clear that only one has to be disproven.
It has to be. But couldn't you have a case where all three of those elements could be disproven?
Sure. I think in this case, the state actually made that argument in summation that they had disproved all three of these.
So they're not inherently contradictory to one another.
I think they're just marginally related for purposes of self-defense. But even this case provides the perfect illustration of how they are so distinct. When the state was arguing in summation that it had disproved all three, it was pointing to different evidence in the record as to which ones went to each prong. With regards to necessity, the state had argued that the defendant in this case did not have a reasonable belief to use deadly force because the evidence didn't suggest that the victim actually went for the defendant's handgun. And in making that argument, the state had pointed to different witness testimony from people at the bar, as well as the testimony of the medical examiner who discussed some of the injuries that may have been inconsistent with the victim actually grabbing. With regard to provocation, the state pointed to the defendant's acts of his words, his pacing, his actions of trying, of allegedly trying to egg the victim out or goad the victim out of the bar, and relied on witness testimony for that proposition. And then with regards to retreat, the state argued that at the moment deadly force was used, when Mr. Macchio was essentially being pinned down at that point, he could have summoned for help. He was a police officer. In essence, the state argued that he should have known better and could have called for help. He could have left the scene before this incident happened.
Right. Wasn't the argument on provocation and retreat similar in that it was, you know, after the defendants had fought and then they shook hands, and I'm sorry, after the defendant and Mr. Gaffney had fought and then they shook hands and Mr. Gaffney goes back into the bar, that defendant was egging Mr. Gaffney on and trying to get him to come back out rather than retreating and just leaving the bar and leaving it alone? Couldn't that be both retreat and provocation?
All these things could happen in the vacuum of a fluid set of facts, for sure. But I think, too, the state did point to the fact that this individual, this defendant, was a police officer. There were other people at the scene. He could have asked for help. He could have summoned help as an officer by calling 911 or something to that effect. So there were different facts that the state was establishing for each of these elements. And I think what's important to keep in mind is that the state's burden on these elements is beyond a reasonable doubt, the same burden that is placed on the state for proving elements of an offense. It can't be said that that burden is met when you have a disagreement amongst the jury as to what the defendant actually did, where you have a fragmented verdict, where some jurors think the defendant may have provoked and others may have thought that he could have retreated. That certitude that is required for unanimity just is not satisfied by a verdict in that's so fragmented.
If we split it up into three, coming back to what I asked co-counsel before, let's say the jury finds that there was, in fact, the ability to retreat on that question, but then they separately find that the use of force was necessary. How do you reconcile that? It seems like there's at least the two of them are fundamentally, potentially inconsistent, no?
Well, that's my argument, is that the elements are essentially different. I wouldn't necessarily call them inconsistent. They all fall under the self-defense umbrella, if you will, but they are requiring different considerations. For example, necessity is looking really at the mens rea, the mental state of the defendant in that moment when he is using deadly force, whereas
well, it's also looking at the reasonableness of the conduct. And if it's there's a reasonable way to avoid it by escaping, then how could you possibly split it up and be confident that the verdict has integrity? Wouldn't it be sufficient, as I asked before, just to put it all under the umbrella of necessity, because that, at least with regard to the ability to escape, it subsumes it, no?
I don't think so, Your Honors. And I think because deadly force was used here, there is that additional special consideration as to the duty to retreat. So that has to be its own consideration, especially under this fact pattern. So where they might, in a sense, slightly overlap, it's that additional duty that's placed on the defendant that the jury is considering there versus the actual necessity to use deadly force.
But to follow up on Judge Sabatino's question again, but at the point that the jury's considering the retreat, they have already had to consider the necessity because, the questions are kind of a progression, right?
Correct.
Because
correct.
The first question asks the jury, has the state proven beyond a reasonable doubt that defendant's belief to use the force was, to save his life, was not honest or reasonable?
Correct.
If the jury determines yes, the state has proven that defendant's belief was not honest or reasonable, then the jury's done.
Exactly.
The jury's done. Self-defense is out.
Correct.
So, it's kind of thinking of it as a jury verdict sheet. So would it make sense to have the questions presented to the jury that way? Question number one, as we just explained, if you answer yes, then you're done. Then self-defense is out. But if the answer is no to that first question and that jury believes that defendant's belief was honest and reasonable, then move to question number two. Because question number two begins with the premise that the jury believes defendant's belief that he had to use deadly force was honest and reasonable. Notwithstanding that the defendant's belief was honest and reasonable, did the state prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant provoked the encounter? Again, if the answer is yes, defendant provoked. Again, the jury is done at that point. No self-defense. If the answer is no, then the jury moves on to the next question. Because the next question, number three, again, starts from the premise of the jury believes that the jury has found that the defendant's belief that he had to use the deadly force was honest and reasonable, and that the defendant did not provoke the encounter. But although those things are true, two things are true, defendant had the ability, did the state prove that the defendant had the ability to retreat? Again, if the answer is yes, no self-defense. If the answer is no, then defendant's not guilty, right? So
correct.
It's kind of a progression.
It's a progression, correct.
Questions are a progression. So I think it is hard to just separate them out and say, no, let's look at number three and, talk about it in that way, because it's a complete progression.
Correct. I do believe it is a progression in that sense. But also, I'm just looking at the elements. There is where I think Judge Sabatino you're getting hung up is that if we're thinking of like the classic case where the defendant was standing upright and he had the weapon and as deadly force is being used against him or in the moment it's about to be used against him, did he have the choice to use the weapon or run? There would be some overlap here, but in a case like this where we're looking at different, essentially, time frames of the defendants pinned on the ground, obviously retreat might not be appropriate at that point, but it was appropriate slightly earlier in that confrontation. I think that's where they are somewhat distinct, and that's where the jury is looking at different elements for each of these, or different evidence for each of these elements.
If we're going to parse it that way, though, wouldn't the first, whether you're calling it an element or a means or a reason or a basis, wouldn't that actually be two or maybe even three? Because it seems like it's encompassing defendant did not have an honest belief. It can either be defendant did not have an honest belief that he needed to use force, or it can be defendant did not have a reasonable belief that he needed to use force. So as long as you disprove either honest or reasonable, then it's not self-defense, correct?
Correct. Well, I think the statute reads honest and reasonable, so it would be both. In this case...
Correct, but that means that the defendant needs to... I understand the burden of proof is on the state, but my question is, that means the state only has to disprove one.
Sure,
so
and
if
actually,
the state proves that it was not honest, but it was reasonable, or it was reasonable, but it was not honest, then it's still not self-defense.
You're correct, Your Honor. And in this case, the state did make that argument. I think the state in summation said that Mr. Macchio may have had an honest belief, but it wasn't reasonable. So yes, they, both would, the defense, for the defense to apply, would have to be honest and reasonable.
So now we're talking about it as four separate elements, and there would need to be a unanimous instruction sequentially on all four of those?
Well, I think that makes up its own element. And I, really what that kind of goes into is almost that Richardson line of cases where we're talking about the means versus or brute facts or means, where the actus reus, they have to be, the jury has to be unanimous on that, but not necessarily the means. So I think in that instance, as long as they have found that this prong wasn't proven because some thought he was acting not reasonably while others thought he was not acting honestly, it would be fine, because that's not, those are just the brute facts that underlie. I think a better.
So take that to the next level, to the overarching question with respect to unanimity. And I want you to respond to a passage in Mekoshvili.
Okay.
Just as jurors need not agree as to the specific details by which the state proves each element of a charged crime, they need not agree as to the specific factors or triggering circumstances by which it disproves a claim of self-defense.
Right. So I think the overarching thing and the overarching issue that we have with the out-of-state cases is that those cases clearly rely heavily on jurisprudence that suggests that general unanimity instructions are sufficient. They don't have a Parker analysis, which is actually my next, the next thing I wanted to address, where we are looking at two different considerations to determine if a specific unanimity instruction is required. So I think there too, the states in those cases also rely heavily on that Richardson line of cases with regards to brute facts and means. Our court doesn't really rely so heavily on that line of cases. We have our Parker test, which requires that the trial court look to two things. First, for whether a specific unanimity instruction is required, the court has to look to see if these elements are only marginally related, or really if they are conceptually distinct. If they are, then a specific unanimity instruction is required. And I think I have already really touched upon the distinctness of each of these elements. The second thing is jury confusion. If there is the potential for jury confusion, there too should be a specific unanimity instruction. So that's the test our courts follow. The Connecticut court does not follow that test. So I think if this court is going to decide this issue, it should decide it through the lens of Parker and our test, which is more protective of unanimity as a whole.
So does that response put the cart before the horse? By labeling them elements, you lead to a certain outcome as you analyze the Parker test. Are they elements? Are they considerations? Are they triggering events?
I again submit that these are elements simply because they not only are so distinct, but also they do have these different actus reus and mens rea requirements that the jury has to look at. These aren't just merely definitions of what self-defense is. These are distinct findings that the jurors have to consider in order to determine if self-defense applies or doesn't.
Didn't our case law, though, focus on, and specifically Frisbee and Gentry also, focusing on the jury needing to unanimously agree on which specific acts the defendant committed against which specific victim? Here, obviously, every juror had to agree that the defendant shot Mr. Gaffrey. What different acts or victims are really at issue here?
So yes, we don't have different victims in this case. And I think when we're looking at the unanimity case law, it does, it's a little all over the map with regards to what facts are at issue as to what has to be unanimous. So like you said, in Gentry, we're talking about victims. I think in other cases, it was underlying theories. Here, again, these I would submit that these necessity, provocation, or retreat are all separate elements of self-defense that the jury has to consider based on different evidence. They are more akin to different theories that could lead to the same result, which our courts have found that requires a specific unanimity instruction. So that's what I would be pointing to here, that these are, in fact, different elements.
Were the facts of this case, and I know they were disputed, but were the facts conceptually difficult or complex once a jury determined which side of the aisle it credited?
So I think, and this is a distinction that the appellate division made in this case, where the outset, we're looking at a case that is essentially involving a fight with a shooting. So not as a global theme, that's not really a complex case. But when you start to look at these three elements, that's where the complexity lies, because that's where the jurors have to really parse the evidence, the different stages, even though the fight was probably a mere minutes, the different stages of that to determine if each of these prongs were actually satisfied here or not. And I would submit that, so on a global scale, no, because this is just, again, a fight involving a shooting. That doesn't typically sound complex, but it does get somewhat more complex when we're looking at these specific elements.
Questions, anyone? Thank you, Ms. Nassau.
Thank you so much.
Ms. Simon.
Good morning, Your Honors. The Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey believes that a general verdict rejecting self-defense is insufficient, and due process requires the jury to agree to one or more of the legal bases in rejecting the justification. To assist the court in reaching its own conclusion, I'd like to direct Your Honor's attention to a single place in the law, and that is the dividing line between material legal elements on the one hand and underlying brute facts or the means of proving those legal elements on the other. The reason that dividing line—
Did you say underlying brute facts?
Underlying brute facts, yes, Your Honor. Or means of proving those legal elements on the other side. I will call this dividing line the due process divide. As the Chief has already suggested, material legal elements on the one hand must be agreed to by a unanimous jury, that's Richardson. On the other hand, underlying brute facts or the means of proving those legal elements do not require juror unanimity. So the question before the court could essentially be reframed as, are these three prongs of self-defense material legal elements, or are they underlying brute facts, simply means of proving the single legal element of self-defense?
Do you have any law on what constitutes an element?
I absolutely do.
Okay. And also law applying the term element to something that is not what we would sort of typically consider an element in a statute, which would be the mens rea and et cetera and causation.
I understand, Your Honor. I can absolutely answer your first question. I am hopeful that I can answer your second question. There are two sources of law where we find legal definitions distinguishing legal elements on the one hand and underlying brute facts on the other. The first is in federal controlling jurisprudence from the U.S. Supreme Court, Richardson and Mathis. But I'd actually like to start with the New Jersey statutory scheme. So it's the association's position that this question has already been addressed and answered by the New Jersey legislature. That's at NJSA 2C:1-14 subsections H and I-2. Subsection H, and I'd just like to note, this is the definitions section for the entirety of Title 2C. So these definitions apply to the rest of 2C, including our self-defense statute, which is in Section 2C. Subsection H defines elements of an offense. Subsection H says that an element of an offense is such conduct or such attendant circumstances, such as negative a justification.
I'm sorry, conduct and attendant circumstances.
Conduct is H1. Attendant circumstances is subsection H2, such as to subsection C below subsection 2, negative a justification. Subsection I2 defines material elements of an offense, distinct from just legal elements of an offense. Material elements of an offense are those elements that are not unconnected with the existence of a justification or excuse.
I'm glad we have such clarity.
Can you imagine?
Can you go back to negative a justification?
Yes, I can.
Is negative being, is a verb there?
It is a verb, and my understanding is that it means to disprove, such as would disprove a justification. And thank you, Justice, because my very next line was to say, you know, applying our longstanding canons of statutory interpretation, the association's position is that this language is plain and unambiguous and so should be given its ordinary meaning, such that all facts which comprise conduct or attendant circumstances, which standing alone would negative a justification, constitute elements of an offense, and specifically material elements of a legal offense.
So help us with this, because
please.
It uses the language justification.
Yes, it does.
And self-defense is the justification.
That's right.
You're going to the layer beneath that.
Yes.
And applying the term justification to each of the factors
that are
contained there.
Why?
How do you get there?
Sure. It's because the statutory definition applies independently to each of the three prongs of self-defense. And what I mean is, let's start with necessity. Necessity would fall under subsection H because it is an attendant circumstance which standing alone would negative a justification. Separately, totally separate and apart, right? Provocation. That provocation
so the
is a conduct.
The justification is self-defense.
Right.
And the negativing to... I'm really out on a limb here, but then to negative a justification would be the state proving beyond a reasonable doubt any of the three, which would so-called negative the justification.
That's right, and it's because each of the prongs of self-defense independently meets the definition. If only self-defense, the overall justification, met the definition of subsection H, then we might agree with the state. But the association's position is that because each of the three prongs is either a conduct in the term of provocation or an attendant circumstance in the sense of the necessity of the use of deadly force or the ability to safely retreat. Each of those independently meets the statutory definition for an element of an offense. To the extent the language is ambiguous, because it's a criminal statute, it must be construed in the defendant's favor. And I think the most important canon of statutory construction applicable here is that it must be interpreted such as to give this provision legal effect. And it's important because the state's supplemental brief at page 26 essentially argues that it should not. The state's brief just says this statute does not transform the defense of self-defense into a legal element. But no transformation is required here. This is simply applying plain and unambiguous language.
So is there anywhere else in the code where there could be, I'm going to use negative as a verb here, a provision allowing for the state to, quote unquote, negative a justification other than in self-defense?
Sure. It is the association's position that this provision applies to all justification defenses. It's plain and unambiguous language. So duress would be an example of another one.
Does duress, and I haven't looked this up, does duress as a justification have a three-pronged or two-pronged test for overcoming the justification? I'm not crazy about the word negative as a verb. I've got to get used to that, apparently.
You know, Your Honor, the short answer is I don't know off the top of my head.
See what I'm saying? Is this scenario applicable to anything else but self-defense?
I think this scenario, the statutory language, would apply. So let's say, for argument's sake, duress does have two elements. Then I think that each of those elements would require unanimity. And that's because the legislature told us that it does.
There's law from other jurisdictions in related contexts that you don't need unanimity as to whether one is an aider and abettor as opposed to a principal. Would that be good law in New Jersey in light of Section 2C:14?
No, it wouldn't, Judge.
1-14.
And for exactly the reason that you just said, that it's our legislative determination as opposed to, you know, the legislative determination of Connecticut or Colorado or Texas that defines what is material for purposes of this state and how we interpret our criminal statutes. I would add that the federal jurisprudence here only bolsters this interpretation. I'll do it shorthand. Richardson and Mathis essentially both hold that material legal elements, on the one hand, are facts with legal consequence. These are the facts that the jury must find the state has proved beyond a reasonable doubt in order to sustain a conviction, whereas underlying facts do not have legal consequence. So we know, even just from that sort of broad brush definition, that the three prongs of self-defense each independently have legal consequence. Only one needs to be found in order for the defense to be defeated.
Can I stop you there about your word?
Please.
Independently.
Sure.
Now, it was anticipated that you might be able to help my quandary. Isn't a finding of the ability to retreat subsumed within the question of necessity? I mean, how could the jury answer, yes, it was honest and reasonable belief to use force, but then later say, oh, but he could have retreated? They don't work, do they?
Oh, I think they do.
How do you harmonize that kind of a verdict?
I suppose I don't find those facts to be inconsistent standing alone, that it would be possible that a reasonable person who honestly believed that deadly force was necessary, but here in New Jersey, we have this duty to retreat.
But if there's a duty to retreat, how is it reasonable to use the force?
I do think there are distinct inquiries, whether or not whether it was reasonable and necessary to use deadly force in those circumstances, or else, again, the legislature might not have made them distinct elements. I don't find them inconsistent, Judge. I apologize.
Nothing to apologize for.
Yeah. I guess to close, I would say that giving legal effect to subsections H and I 2 essentially mandates the conclusion that these are three distinct elements that require specific juror unanimity, which itself requires the conclusion that specific unanimity instructions are required. I would add that the association is in favor of adding, you know, a sentence or two to the model jury charge, as well as ensuring. I'm a big fan of Justice Pierre-Louise's sort of progressive jury verdict sheet, but certainly an amendment to a jury verdict sheet would be helpful.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. When a defendant raises a claim of self-defense, the jury is tasked with determining whether the state has disproved defendant's claim beyond a reasonable doubt that his otherwise illegal act of using deadly force was justified. In making that determination, they must unanimously agree upon one thing, that the defendant's use of deadly force was not justified. To come to that conclusion, they must consider circumstances or triggering factors which indicate that a defendant is not entitled to that defense, namely the belief that deadly force was honest and the need for deadly force was honest and reasonable, that the defendant provoked the attack with the intent to cause death or serious bodily injury, or that the defendant could have retreated in complete safety. Yet despite these different reasons for rejecting defendant's assertion that his otherwise illegal act was legal, the jury must reach the same conclusion unanimously, that the state proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant's use of deadly force was not justified. Importantly, it is the absence of self-defense and not the underlying theory that is subject to the reasonable doubt standard and that unanimity standard. Due process, New Jersey case law, and the case law of sister jurisdictions require no more. In every criminal prosecution, the state is required to prove each element of the charged offense beyond a reasonable doubt. In nearly all circumstances, a general unanimity charge has been found to be sufficient. To this end, jurors do not need to agree on the brute facts and circumstances that make up each particular element. As Justice Blackmun stated in McCoy versus North Carolina, different jurors may be persuaded by different evidence, even if they agree on the bottom line. In New Jersey, a specific unanimity instruction has been reserved for certain circumstances, but those cases are the exception to the rule and not the rule. Far more often, a general unanimity instruction is all that is required. Indeed, when applying the principles of State v. Parker and its progeny to determine whether a specific unanimity charge is required, it is clear that self-defense does not raise the concerns that those cases addressed. Specifically, when considering a claim of self-defense, jurors will not reach a fragmented verdict based upon different theories supported by different acts or evidence. This is because when addressing self-defense, jurors are asked to look at the defendant's discrete act within a specific moment, and that is the moment that the defendant used deadly force at a particular time. Even if the jurors rely upon different reasons for their conclusions that the defendant's actions were not justified, their guilty verdict is a unanimous finding based upon that one act. Accordingly, there is little risk that jury will reach a fragmented verdict as described in Parker and Frisbee. In the same way, because the jury is asked to consider defendant's discrete act at a particular moment, self-defense will not cause the jury confusion, certainly not to the extent, and particularly as demonstrated in this case, that we would be prevented or cured by a specific unanimity charge. Because self-defense does not raise the concerns addressed in Parker and Frisbee, there is no need for that specific unanimity charge. Additionally, despite the arguments of amicus and the defendant that under 2C114H, the state must disprove each element of self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt, it is the state's position that self-defense is not an element of an offense, but is rather an affirmative defense. But even assuming if this court were to interpret 2C114H to mean that self-defense is an element to be disproved beyond a reasonable doubt, the three ways in which the state can disprove self-defense are not elements themselves of self-defense. Elements of an offense are part of a whole. Each element needs to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt to establish an intended goal, and that is in a criminal case that a defendant is guilty of a specific crime. However, the three ways to disprove self-defense are fundamentally different because they are not parts of a whole. Rather, each method for disproving self-defense is independently sufficient to accomplish the end goal, a finding that defendant's conduct was not justified. Because of this inherent and important difference, the reasons for rejecting self-defense are not elements, they should not be called elements, and they should not be treated as elements. Rather, as sister jurisdictions have held, they are triggering circumstances or factors relative to the determination of whether defendant's use of deadly force was justified. Indeed, they are called conditions in New Jersey's model jury charge. They are the brute facts, the why defendant is not entitled to a justification defense. As a result, the jury need not be unanimous in their finding which theory the state proved to negate defendant's claim of self-defense, so long as they agree that defendant's conduct was not justified under the law. Moreover, the practical application of a specific unanimity charge as to self-defense would have absurd consequences. To require a jury to agree on the specific brute facts and legal theories underlying their conclusion that the defendant's use of force was not justified would undoubtedly result in hung juries, despite the unanimous agreement that defendant's use of force was not justified. As the Connecticut Supreme Court stated in State v. Mikoshvili, the court stated, we fail to see how the purposes behind the unanimity requirement would be served by requiring a properly charged jury, one instructed that it had been unanimous in its rejection of self-defense, to engage in further deliberations to reach unanimous consensus as to the specific brute facts and legal theories underlying the conclusion that the defendant's use of force was unjustified under the circumstances. To require jurors to agree on such details would result in hung juries in cases in which the jurors actually agree on the defendant's guilt. For these reasons, it's the state's position that a specific unanimity charge is not required when a defendant asserts a claim of self-defense, and the decision of the appellate division in this case should be affirmed.
I want to ask you a few questions about 2C1-14 that Ms. Simon has relied upon. As a threshold matter, did I understand you to say that because this is an affirmative defense, it doesn't fall within Section 14?
It's the state's position that self-defense is not an element. It is an affirmative defense. However,
yes, but
whether
but
or not it...
The statute speaks to excuse or justification. Doesn't self-defense qualify under that?
It could be considered.
So now, with that in mind, is provocation conduct that could negate the justification or excuse of self-defense?
Provocation with the intent to cause serious bodily injury would be a triggering factor that negates self-defense.
So that sounds like the answer is yes.
Yes, that factor is an element, or that is an act.
14H says conduct that negates an excuse is an element of an offense. Is provocation an element of an offense as a result of that black letter law?
I would submit that it is not that the state is not required to prove the specific brute fact, and that 2C114 has not been interpreted to require that the state prove each act to establish culpability or mens rea. For example, in establishing mens rea, the state may prove a number of acts or conduct that persuade a jury to believe that the defendant's mens rea was knowing and purposeful. But the state is not required to prove with a specific unanimity as to each act or conduct that the defendant committed.
As a general proposition, I understand the answer, but I'm asking you to focus on the specific statutory language and tell us whether it overrides that more general argument. Same question with respect to retreat. Is retreat conduct that could negate the justification, that could negate the crime?
Again, Chief, I would say that while it is conduct, it is not conduct that negates the excuse or justification. It is a triggering factor that indicates that the defendant's use of deadly force was not justified. That is the act or conduct that must be disproved beyond a reasonable doubt to the jury's unanimity.
So
unanimous decision.
Yes, self-defense must be disproved in one of the three ways. But the question is, does the language of the statute tell us more than that?
The language of the statute describes elements of an offense, and that it describes act or conduct as that negates an excuse or justification. However, it's the state's position that it has not been interpreted to mean that brute fact of whether or not the defendant's ability to retreat or the defendant's provocation has to be decided unanimously.
So what would it be? What's an example then of something else that negatives an excuse or justification for such conduct if it's not what the chief is asking about? So what is the statute referring to here when it specifically says an element of the offense means such conduct or attendant circumstances as negatives an excuse or justification? So if it doesn't mean provocation or retreat, what is it referring to?
It would be the defendant's belief that deadly force was necessary beyond a reasonable doubt. The defendant's use of deadly force was not the defendant did not have an honest and reasonable belief that deadly force was necessary at the time that it was used.
So do you agree?
So you're saying prong one then is an element, but prongs two and three are not?
Well, I think that the way that the statute is worded and what is required is that the self-defense requires that the defendant have an honest and reasonable belief that deadly force was necessary in order to avoid serious bodily injury or death. And then the second, which is really not a prong that's specifically enumerated within the 2C statute, is basically the negative of that requirement, that the defendant have an honest and reasonable belief that deadly force was necessary. The other two are triggering factors that say even if this defendant had this belief, he doesn't get a self-defense if he provoked the attack with the intent to cause serious bodily injury, or he had the ability to safely retreat.
Does the ability to retreat, you know what's coming.
Yes, I do.
Isn't that subsumed within a reasonable belief that the force is necessary? Isn't it subsumed within the more broad language of the first factor?
No, Your Honor, and having listened to everyone else's answer, I have my own. And that would be because there are certainly circumstances where a defendant would personally have an honest and reasonable belief that deadly force was necessary and ignore the ability to retreat.
Well, wouldn't that be an unreasonable belief then, if there's the ability to retreat in complete safety?
No, I don't agree with that.
Can I take you back to your response to Justice Wiener-Apter about
sure.
the structure? Of the self-defense statute here. Don't all three prongs rise or fall in the same fashion? because the statute basically says as to the first factor, the use of deadly force is not justifiable, dot, dot, dot. And then the second and the third factors have the precise same introduction, nor is it justifiable if, dot, dot, dot. So if your answer is that the first prong is an element, then doesn't that mean the second and the third prongs are as well?
If the state were to concede that it is an element,
are you conceding that?
I will concede for the purpose of this argument.
No. Okay.
Are you
reserving it for?
No, Your Honor. It's because it's of no moment whether or not whether it's an element or not. Because even if it were to be considered an element, it is just whether or not the defendant's use of force was justified that must be disproven beyond a reasonable doubt. That would be considered the essential element. The other factors are merely triggering factors that say this defendant was not entitled to that. To that justification defense.
Let's make sure we're talking on the same plane. Are there two factors or three factors as you read the statute?
As I read the statute, there are two factors.
Is reasonable belief one of the factors, a reasonable and honest belief that such force is necessary? Is that one of the factors?
A reasonable belief that, yes, it is a factor. I apologize. So there are three. There would be a reasonable belief is an honest and reasonable belief that deadly force was necessary.
So if you concede that that is an element that needs to be proven unanimously, then have you conceded the second and the third prongs?
The state's position is that the element that needs to be disproved is that the defendant's use of force was not justified. That is the element. The other three are triggering factors that indicate that he was not entitled to that defense.
And is it actually four for the reasons that we've previously discussed in terms of reasonable and honest being two separate parts or two separate prongs within what has been previously characterized as one prong?
And I don't know that the actual statute says honest and reasonable. I believe the model jury charge says honest and reasonable. Whether or not those are two separate factors that need to be determined, they are, I would say that they are together. I'm not answering your question. So defendant amicus point to 2C114H in support of their position that self-defense is the self-defense and the enumerated factors in 3, 4A and B are elements that require unanimous finding beyond a reasonable doubt. However, it's the state's position that the statute has not been interpreted to mean that jurors must unanimously agree as to the facts that establish the actus reus, the mens rea, or the reason negating an excuse, justification, or defense. Our case law does not require a jury to agree on whether a defendant was the principal or an accomplice of an offense, what type of weapon was used, or the acts that establish a specific kind of culpability, all of which could be considered acts or conduct, attendant circumstances, or result of conduct that establishes the prohibited conduct, the mens rea, or that negates an excuse or defense. For example, as I stated before, the state can establish mens rea, or the B of the 114H1B, and required culpability through various means. For murder, maybe the showing that the defendant purchased a gun, that he conducted internet searches of how to dispose of a body, and sent text messages luring the victim to the location. All of these acts are conduct. All of these acts establish the required culpability, but the jury is not required to agree on which act or combination of acts establishes knowing and purposeful murder. Rather, these are preliminary factual issues, not material factors.
Similarly, in addressing self-defense, the state must prove the defendant's use of force was not justified. The manner in which the claim of self-defense is negated is not a material element, but triggering factors that contribute to the finding that the defendant's conduct was not justified. These are the brute facts that underlie the actus reus, upon which the jury is not required to unanimously agree. Indeed, to require the state to prove the manner and means by which the defendant's use of deadly force was not justified would be holding the state to an even higher burden than it's held to in proving the actual elements of a charged crime. This reason is essentially reiterated in the recent Supreme Court case.
Why is that? It's reasonable, beyond a reasonable doubt in both cases, is it not?
Because the state would be required to prove the actual acts, as opposed to what's required with regard to the actual elements of an offense. The state is not required to prove the actual, to have unanimity with regard to the actual facts that make up each of the required act or mens rea. But now, if a specific unanimity charge were required, it would now be holding the state to a higher burden to disprove self-defense, in that it must convince the jurors each to unanimously agree on specific facts.
But using Frisbee as an example, mm-hmm. there's the burden on the state is beyond a reasonable doubt, and the state was required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt one or the other. Two alternative mm-hmm. methods of getting to endangering, if I remember that case correctly.
Correct.
So why is that different?
Well, that's different because in that particular case, there were different theories relying upon different evidence that had the distinct possibility of having a fragmented verdict. So for that reason, it was required for a specific, required that the jury specifically find facts because those facts related to different theories and different charges. They were different acts or conduct related to different theories.
But when you say that this would require unanimity on this issue would make it a higher burden on the state to disprove self, I think I heard you say this.
Correct.
Disprove self-defense than it would in proving an element of the offense. There are some offenses as to which the state has to get unanimity on an element, on a traditional element, to use the mens rea or something along those lines.
In cases where it's been determined that there's a possibility of a fragmented verdict, where there are distinct separate acts that are alleged and set forth by the state, then yes, those would be circumstances where a specific unanimity charge would be appropriate. However, in most general cases, a general unanimity charge is sufficient, where the state does not have to prove each of the brute facts to the jury's satisfaction unanimously. That's what would be imposed upon the state in this case, where the state would be put to the burden of establishing the underlying factual circumstances that to the juror's unanimity to establish that this defendant is not entitled to a justification defense.
Would that incentivize the state to pick one of the three and go with it? See what I mean?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that the state doesn't always get to pick a self-defense, what theory of self-defense. This is a defense that is largely driven by the defendant.
No, but I mean in terms of overcoming the defense. The state has three options. It has to simply disprove one.
I would think that a trial assistant prosecutor would not risk just one. If the facts and circumstances supported one, two, or three, then absolutely those would be pursued and not just pick just one. Additionally, in a circumstance like this, in this case, there's videotape, there's numerous witnesses who observed the event. In many circumstances, it's merely the defendant's testimony, unfortunately, alone, because the victim is deceased. So the state would be relying solely on the version that is set forth by the defendant, and having to negate those assertions or those claims set forth by the defendant, to negate the specific facts beyond a reasonable doubt, would be putting the state to a higher burden. Additionally, even looking to that example, that in this case we have video, in other cases, such as Mikoshvili, where the defendant testified and the victim was deceased, the court looked to the fact that it was quite possible for, in the jury's deliberations, for the jury to look to the defendant's version of events. Some may have completely discounted it and indicated that it was a fabrication. Some may have believed some of it, but found that the defendant was still not justified in use of force. In that case, that would be a non-unanimous decision as to the underlying facts of the case. But in those circumstances, the defendant, the jury may have been unanimous in their finding that the defendant was not justified in his use of deadly force. So for that reason, it's the state's position that a specific unanimity charge for those reasons is not required, and not required in this case. So unless your honors have any.
Thank you, Ms. Buckley. Thank you. Mr. Yamtov.
Good morning, your honors. There seems to be I don't want to use the word confusion, because that's kind of what this case is about, some differences or how to approach this analytically. And what I'm going to try to do is, my attempt is to show, using established case law, such as Shad and Richardson from the U.S. Supreme Court, our case law, Parker, Frisbee, et cetera, and try to reconcile it with the statute 2C1-14, because that seems to be the issue that the court is struggling with. I think we're all struggling with. There's a clear distinction between the state's burden to prove a crime and the state's burden to disprove a defense. And the key words there is proving a crime and disproving. Think of it as self-defense is the element that the state has to, quote, disprove. And that when you're talking about an element of an offense or a material element of an offense, those are of a charged offense, such as murder, manslaughter, whatever. Each element is part of a whole. You have to independently find each element. With self-defense, that's not required. And I think that the Mikoshvili case from the Supreme Court of Connecticut really hones in on this, and I love the word triggering circumstance, meaning that each one independently can be relied on by the state to disprove self-defense. It's not part of a whole. As Judge Sabatino was struggling with the three circumstances, is there some inconsistency? Maybe in a particular case. I personally think each one could be applied in this case. But the point is that it doesn't matter, because like the elements of an offense, the underlying details, such as the mode or the means, in other words, the defendant who kills, strangles somebody, and then sets, and I think Justice Scalia gave this example, burns down the house. You have a charred body, you can't tell the manner of which, the way the person was killed. He says, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if he rendered the victim unconscious and set fire and that's what led to the death. We don't need to look at those underlying details, just as we don't need to look at defendant's role in a crime, whether he's the getaway driver or the shooter. That to me sounds like something, you know, there's language in Frisbee which, and Parker, which talks about, oh, there's got to be certitude of what defendant did. Well, that's not exactly accurate. The point is that you need to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the element. You don't need to prove the means or the modes. You don't even need to agree on mental state. You can be convicted of murder in this state, whether it's intentional or felony murder. So to say that all the jurors agree that defendant was not justified in the use of self-defense, but they can't agree on, well, did he really need to use force? Or was he the one who provoked the victim in this case? And he wanted to kill him after the reconciliation. Or when he's down on the ground and you have a dozen people out there pulling Gaffney up, why did he have to take out his gun and shoot him? Couldn't he have just stopped? Said, no. I'm done. He could have done that. And Mr. Gaffney would probably be alive today. So when all the jurors looked at the evidence, maybe some of them said, you know what, maybe he felt the need to defend himself. This guy's big, he's bashing my head down. But some jurors would say, well, he provoked us. He's egging this guy on. And he wants to get him back because he humiliated him. But other jurors might say, you know what? He's on the ground, people are pulling him up, telling him to stop, whatever. I don't have a record of that. I'm just editorializing. But the point is, they're pulling him up. He could have just said, all right, I quit. He could have said that, but he didn't.
So your point is that if you have jurors on A, four jurors on B, four jurors on C, there's no problem.
Correct.
Square that with the statute.
Please. Elements of an offense. Interestingly, I'm going to answer your question, Chief. If you look at Mikoshvili, unfortunately we don't have a Northeast site yet, at 344 Connecticut 673 on pages 686 to 687, the Supreme Court of Connecticut says, for most crimes, the state must persuade every juror that the core components of the crime, the requisite mens rea, the actus reus, and any required results or intended circumstances have been established. When the legislature drafted this, well, I remind you, this is based on the Model Penal Code. What it was referring to was, yes, the elements of an offense can be self-defense. It can be statute of limitations, just as this court saw in Kavanaugh. It can be territorial jurisdiction, as this court addressed in DeNova. And there can be, just like with elements of a crime, material elements of a crime, there could be facts and evidence that can be disputed. Jurors don't have to agree on every underlying detail, such as the conduct, the attendant circumstances.
I want to come back to the statute. Does Connecticut have a statute similar to Section 14?
I'm sorry.
Does Connecticut have a statute similar to 2C114?
I don't know. I don't know.
Let's focus on that statute and its terms. and explain, respond to the questions that the court previously posed to Ms. Buckley. Is retreat, is provocation conduct that negates?
Like I just said, if we are to apply, it doesn't say anything about unanimity. Unanimity is this to the element. The element is self-defense. Otherwise, you're going to turn Parker and Frisbee on its head. Because attendant circumstances, I mean, that's pretty broad, to say the least. Are we now going to require jurors to determine whether a defendant is a principal or an accomplice? Why would we have higher burdens for self-defense, which the state doesn't have the burden of proof on? It just has to disprove the theory that defendant is advancing. But we don't have to prove the underlying facts for the elements of a crime. That just makes no certain. That's absurd.
Do you have the language of the statute in front of you, Mr. Yamto?
I'm sorry?
Do you have the language in front of you?
Yeah, sure.
So tease out that point with respect to H.A.
Mm-hmm.
If read literally, attendant circumstances included in the description of forbidden conduct would be an element that would necessarily require unanimity? And that goes to the point that you're making, that we would have unanimous determinations on a host of things?
Absolutely. And that's not what the case law says. To be honest, I think this is just a definition breaking out the difference between material elements of an offense. Look at it this way. Material elements of an offense are those which are not in dispute. And unless stipulated, okay, the state has the burden to prove each one beyond a reasonable doubt. The elements of an offense is to capture all those other elements which may or may not be in dispute, such as statute of limitations, territorial jurisdiction, and self-defense. Why would we impose a higher burden on an element of an offense and not on a material element of an offense? That makes no sense. And we're supposed to avoid absurd results. And that would be an absurd result, just as if all the jurors agree that defendant was not justified in the killing, but they couldn't agree as to the, it's a melee. It's two guys going at it. You watch the tape, and I urge your honors to watch it. A lot going on. But as the prosecutor pointed out in her brief, there's one distinct act here. One distinct act, when defendant pulls out his gun and decides to use his gun, his firearm, and shoots the victim in the chest three times. That's the discrete act. We're not talking about various acts. We're not talking about different evidence, different theories. And all this is laid out in the briefing. So I urge this court, let me just go over my notes. I think that's part of what we're trying to get at, and there are no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Yamto.
Thank you.
Mr. Skanek, rebuttal?
Yes, very briefly, Your Honor. As far as assisted jurisdictions, the Connecticut Supreme Court, obviously this court in New Jersey, unquestionably provides more constitutional protections than federal law. And the cases are all in the brief: Guarino, Hunt, Schmidt, ODAC, Reed. There's a lot of confusion, and that's kind of my point, that this jury was confused. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.